It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin is joining three other states to form a regional hydrogen hub. We'll talk about hydrogen's potential in the clean energy landscape and why researchers say some forms could make greenhouse gas emissions worse. First, Wisconsin elections have been under intense scrutiny since 2020, with many conservative groups making claims about voter fraud that in most cases haven't yielded significant evidence. More recently, the attention has turned to the state's voter rolls, where activists have sought to uncover ineligible voters who may have participated in elections. Our next guest looked into these claims and investigations, found that there are some gaps in the system and some things that might need to be fixed, but no evidence of widespread numbers of ineligible voters that could affect the results of elections. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered these claims about ineligible voters? What questions do you have? Do you work as a clerk yourself? What kind of things go into managing voter rolls in your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Matthew DeFore is the State House Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Watch, the news arm of the nonpartisan nonprofit Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He previously covered state and local government at the Wisconsin State Journal for 16 years. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, great to be here.
Before we dig into the complaints and the things you found, can you talk about the voter rolls? Who is in charge of saying this person is an eligible voter, this person should be taken off the list?
Sure. There are, in the last presidential election, there were 3.2 million people who cast votes. And the state keeps track of a voter roll list, which has more people than that, because they keep track of all sorts of people, including those who are no longer eligible to vote, people who are dead. And it is up to the local clerks. We have 1,800 election officials in the state who have to make sure that they are staying on top of all the people who are registering to vote and who may no longer be eligible to vote because of issues such as they have a felony on their record and they're still serving a sentence, or they're deceased, or as we found in our investigation, some other examples.
And we've seen, and you report on this, widespread efforts to raise questions about who is on these lists, who should be bumped off. Can you talk about some of the groups involved in these efforts to challenge local clerks and their voter rolls?
Sure. There's a few groups that we found, and this is not something that's limited to just Wisconsin. There are groups across the country, conservative groups, who are trying to find these sort of holes in the election system. In Wisconsin, a couple of these groups worked on former Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman's investigation of the 2020 election. I talked specifically to Ron Hoyer of the Wisconsin Voter Alliance. There's some other groups, but these were folks who they were raising questions about some of the eligibility of voters as part of that investigation, which has, of course, now been shut down.
One of the main categories you look at in this new Wisconsin Watch piece is people under court-ordered guardianships that specify that they are no longer eligible to vote. It gets a little complicated. Can you talk us through who this might cover?
So in Wisconsin, you are guaranteed the right to vote with some exceptions. I mentioned felons who are currently serving a sentence, but there are people who a court can determine may have a cognitive disability and they may not be eligible to vote because a court has decided that. I do not have a full list of the number of people statewide who would fall under that category, but it's obviously a changing number because some of those people pass away. Some people can have their rights restored. And what we found in our investigation is that the problem that this Wisconsin Voter Alliance had when they looked at these folks, and it's the same problem that the Gableman investigation had, is that they were conflating people under a court-ordered guardianship with people who have additionally had their right to vote taken away. And not everybody under a guardianship is ineligible to vote. And that's a really important point that their investigation seemed to gloss over.
Right, and that's a really key point I wanted to bring up. When we hear reports claiming there are thousands of people under guardianships who therefore shouldn't be able to vote, many of those thousands of people might in fact be under guardianships but still have their voting rights intact. Do I have that about right?
Yeah, just to kind of give some perspective on it, I talked to Dane County Clerk of Courts Carlo Esqueda. He pointed out to not just us but also to the Wisconsin Voter Alliance that There were about 1,000 people in Dane County adjudicated as incompetent to vote between 2016 and 2021. But if you take that list and you strip out everybody who is still allowed to vote and who's still living, or you take out people who are no longer living, the number went from about 1,000 down to 281. So they were coming up with this number of thousands. But, you know, Carlos showed that that number is smaller. But that number itself is also misleading because not all of those people may have registered to vote at any point. So they might not even be in the voter system.
Talking to Matt DeFore from Wisconsin Watch about his new report on challenges to voter rolls in communities around the state. You could join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, maybe challenging something like this, or if you've encountered a guardianship in your own family, you're curious about what that means about voting rights. If you've worked in the system yourself, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Matt, again, your reporting found no widespread problems, apparently, that might have swung an election. That said, there were people who slipped through the cracks in some ways in small numbers that you've discovered so far. What did you find?
So there was something surprising here. The Gableman investigation did identify one person in particular in Outagamie County. The report didn't identify who that was, but we were able to find out that person through other means. And this person had voted in November of 2020 and April of 2021, even though she had been adjudicated in February of 2020. And so this set off, I think, a lot of alarm bells for conservatives. But when we dug into that specific case, we didn't find anything suggesting more than perhaps an administrative error for the handoff from, I mean, it's essentially a complicated process for how somebody who is adjudicated incompetent by a court, then that information is passed along to the local clerk. And it looked, there's about three different handoffs that have to happen. And in that case, it looked like the handoff didn't happen. We haven't exactly pinpointed where, but she was still on the voter rolls in November 2020 and April 2021. And we know who signed her absentee ballot. It wasn't somebody, you know,
as a witness.
Yeah, as a witness. I'm sorry, right. Who signed her. We know it was a nursing home employee in 2020. We know it was a local clerk in 2020-21. They did not have the information or had not accessed it in the WEC files until April of 2022. And so that's how that person voted. But just to add to that, what was surprising is that when we asked Dane County Clerk Scott McDonald if he would look at their list of people who are adjudicated ineligible to vote, he looked at 20 of the 1,000 people in Dane County, and he did find two people on that sample who were still active. And I think that caused enough alarm that he's now looking at all 1,000 people on their list to see how many might still be active. One of those two people had cast a vote in April 2019 after being adjudicated in November 2018.
We're talking to Wisconsin Watch reporter Matt DeFore about investigations into Wisconsin's voter rules that turned up minimal evidence of illegally cast votes, but not zero. We'll talk about what the Elections Commission and clerks are doing in response to this coming up, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one had to work through voter eligibility issues yourself? What was your experience like? Do you live or work at a nursing home or assisted living facility? What have you seen when it comes to voting? What questions do you have about this complicated process that's become front and center, at least in some political circles? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Wisconsin Watch State House Bureau Chief Matt DeFore. With us today, sharing his reporting on Wisconsin's voter rolls, challenges to them from some conservative groups, and what happens when people are adjudicated ineligible to vote. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns about this system, questions about it? Is this something that's come up maybe in your own family, somebody being judged not able to vote anymore? How did that work on a practical level for you? What questions do you have? What experiences do you have maybe working in the election system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Matt, let's talk about responses to this. Again, as you said, not widespread numbers, it looks like, of people ineligibly voting, but not zero numbers. I think everybody probably wants to make sure things go right. First of all, from clerks, as you mentioned in Dane County, what kind of efforts are they making to make sure those that handoff of information, the declaration of ineligibility, the Elections Commission, the local clerks are all on the same page?
So the way the process is supposed to work is that what's known as the register and probate in a county court system will get that information that somebody has been deemed ineligible to vote, and they will pass it along to the Wisconsin Elections Commission. One thing we found is that they do that through the snail mail, apparently. That information then needs to be uploaded to a list that the WEC maintains of everybody who has been adjudicated incompetent to vote. And as you can imagine, there are people on that separate list who they've never registered to vote. So they need to keep track of those folks in case they ever try to register. But in this, what we seem to be finding is that there could be cases where that information may not be input correctly, for example, into the WEC files. So a local clerk may miss that information. It could be for somebody in a different city where they're adjudicated, and then when they're being asked to vote in a nursing home in a different county, that local clerk may not have connected the dots that's the same person. One thing we also found with this investigation is that in the 2020 election, of course, the special voting deputies that clerks' offices send into nursing homes were not allowed to go in. And so we had a lot of nursing homes handling the voting. And so that, you know, again, can be another layer where there's just a missed opportunity to catch something like this. But again, it's a very small number. So,
and then at the Wisconsin Elections Commission itself, what kind of changes, tweaks are they considering, enacting, talking about, or deadlocking on?
Yeah, and there's a lot of deadlock lately. They are looking into this issue. So we had found that in their communication with the legislature, this conservative group that brought this attention to the legislature, prompted them to ask WEC. They said that they have been checking into this issue, but they also said that while they acknowledge there could be some of these missed cases, it would require a legislative fix. The legislature would need to specifically tell them how to do the system differently and perhaps more efficiently to make sure that these steps aren't missed. And they have a more efficient system, for example, tracking felons or people who have moved. But in this particular case, it's a very, you know, there's, again, that's multiple steps where human error can be injected at any of those steps. And that's how you might miss, you know, could be dozens of people in the state.
One big difference here, and this comes up in your reporting, is if I'm a felon currently serving a sentence, that's a public record. People are allowed to know that. There's health information involved here for someone who's been declared incompetent to vote. Can you talk about how that affects people trying to get and share this information?
Right. So and it's not just even a health issue. I originally thought this might be HIPAA, but state law specifically bars court officials from revealing the names and addresses of people deemed incompetent to the public. These conservative, the Wisconsin voter line specifically is suing registers and probate in 13 counties to make this information public because they want to check all these names against the voter rolls. But those, you know, the one county has already ruled against them. We'll see if any of those counties you know, allow that information to be public. But yeah, it's not quite the same as public criminal information. This is people whose information is protected.
Right, and the concerns about particularly vulnerable people here. I mean, they might be very vulnerable to a scammer who gets their hands on a list of people in this situation.
You know, that's an interesting irony here, is that these groups are concerned about that very thing happening, and yet they're suing in a way that could make it easier for someone to do that. Right now, I mean, this is part of why we know there's not some grand plan or grand plot here, is because this information is protected. And so I'm not sure how somebody would even go about trying to, scam the system, especially if it's kept private right now.
Let's bring on a caller. Andy is with us in Manitowoc. Andy, hi.
Yes, I wanted to ask about a situation that I know of personally, that in Milwaukee, there was a multi-denominational church group that was asked to go around to nursing homes and pick up ballots and delivering to the multiple drop boxes. And they were specifically told, you know, don't put more than five in each drop box. I don't know what that meant, but they were told that specifically. So they had to go to, you know, maybe two stops or three stops, depending on how many ballots they had. I was wondering what your guest had to say about that.
Andy, thanks for sharing that. A lot of stories going around. Do we have any firsthand stories like that you've encountered, Matt?
Not that story specifically, so I really couldn't comment on what exactly is happening here. But, it, you know, again, it does sound like the type of story that a lot of conservatives have been sort of promoting, this idea of people dropping off ballots at drop boxes. You know, the evidence that such things are happening has been dismissed by, you know, people all the way up to the former Attorney General of the United States, Bill Barr. So I'm not sure what to make of that.
Then looking ahead, Matt, what kind of next steps are you watching for in this story?
So we do want to get an answer to this question. How many people are affected by this? I think doing so helps the public to understand, you know, what it is we're talking about. And again, the unfortunate thing about the Gableman investigation is that it kind of left a lot of these questions unanswered. You know, how many people are we talking about? Is this thousands, as this conservative group has, you know, put out in its communications to local clerks all over the state? Or is it, you know, a smaller sort of, still worth noting, but not concerning maybe to the broader public about how our elections are run? And I think that's what we want to get to the bottom of. I think as we continue to talk with the Dane County Clerk, with the Wisconsin Elections Commission, we want them to be able to say, you know, we've identified the issue. Here's how we're going to fix it going forward.
Matt, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob, for having me.
Matthew DeFore is the State House Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Watch, part of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He's with us today to talk about his reporting on conservative groups' claims of ineligible voters participating in Wisconsin elections at a large scale, and then looking into the process when somebody is declared unable to vote, what happens, what kind of tweaks are needed. Reckless driving is a growing problem in Wisconsin. Statewide traffic fatalities have increased each year since 2019. Towns and cities around the state are trying to combat reckless driving in many ways, including redesigning the roads themselves. But their options are limited on busy urban highways where state policies can override local efforts. Jonah Chester reports.
As a kid living along West Fond du Lac Avenue in Milwaukee, Tristan Thomas saw plenty of reckless driving. A police officer would park blocks away from his home to catch cars barreling down the road.
He would sit there for like 8 to 10 hours every day, pulling people over constantly because they're just flying down the street with no regard for anyone else.
Thomas is 40 and lives in Appleton now, but he's tragically aware reckless driving on Fond du Lac hasn't gotten better since he was young. On the morning of March 12th, his sister Dwinetta Thomas was making a left turn at the intersection of Fond du Lac and Congress Street. A driver in oncoming traffic hit her vehicle. She later died of her injuries.
It's still incredibly hard to believe that she isn't here. We'll have a messenger call where, you know, everybody's got the video cameras on and we're looking at each other, and then it's just, you know, you're waiting for her to come on, and it's like, oh, she's not coming on anymore.
Thomas says Fond du Lac Avenue looks essentially the same as when he was a kid. That's in spite of efforts to make change. The road runs northwest from downtown Milwaukee until it connects with Interstate 41 at the edge of the city. The municipal street is part of State Highway 145, making it what's known as a connecting highway. On roads like this, the Wisconsin Department of Transportation gets final say over any infrastructure changes. That includes traffic calming measures like narrowing pedestrian crossings and reducing lane widths to encourage drivers to slow down. WSDOT gives high priority to traffic flow when considering proposed changes. Advocates like Jordan Morales say that priority hinders new road safety projects. Morales is the vice president of Milwaukee's Sherman Park Community Association.
The Milwaukee Department of Public Works, they're more concerned or becoming more concerned with pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure, and they're actually more concerned about slowing cars down. So you've got kind of two competing philosophies.
A city report from 2019 found 16 of Milwaukee's 25 most crash-prone intersections sat on or near Fond du Lac Avenue or Capitol Drive, another state connecting highway. And from January 2017 to July 2022, 42 people died in traffic collisions along the two roads. That's about 11% of the city's total traffic deaths during that time. Milwaukee officials say WSDOT has allowed some changes on connecting highways. Those include protected turn lanes, as well as concrete bump outs and expanded medians to shorten crosswalks at busy intersections. But Gerald Krushke, Milwaukee's interim commissioner of public works, says WSDOT has rejected more ambitious proposals like narrowing or eliminating lanes.
I think they're starting to understand the needs that we have in the city, which is a good start. I still think we have a long way to go.
Stephen Flottmeyer is the planning chief for WSDOT's southwestern region. He says the department considers the needs of all road users when weighing new projects, but he acknowledges WSDOT typically approaches rural and urban highways with the same set of goals, which includes traffic flow.
The only difference is within the connecting highways, the city plays a much bigger part in the conversation.
Duanetta Thomas's family is among those who would like to see that relationship evolve more quickly. Tristan says they think changes to make Fond du Lac Avenue safer could save families from what they're going through.
It's a gigantic loss for our family. It's a gigantic loss for the community in which she served, and we just have to make sure that nobody else's bright light gets snuffed out.
Duanetta had moved to Sheboygan, but was still in Milwaukee often.
The day she was killed, she was actually dropping someone off at a store. So I think it's apropos that she was out helping someone and then that happened. So she was definitely loved.
Duanetta left behind two adult children and four siblings. Jonah Chester, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at clean hydrogen fuel and whether it has a big role to play in the move away from fossil fuels. And the U.S. House Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol is holding a public hearing tomorrow. We'll bring you live NPR coverage starting at noon. Listen in here on Wisconsin Public Radio or online at WPR.org. And we'll talk about what comes out of that hearing tomorrow on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, TV personality and Queer Eye star Jonathan Van Ness is coming to Wisconsin this week for his comedy tour. He talks about spreading joy, gymnastics, and pumpkins. Now, Governor Tony Evers says Wisconsin is joining three states to form a regional hydrogen hub. It's part of a federal effort to make clean hydrogen a more common power source as part of a wider effort to replace fossil fuels. Last year's bipartisan infrastructure law earmarked billions of dollars in federal funding for clean hydrogen. Wisconsin and neighboring states are hoping to get some of that money to launch this regional network of hydrogen producers, consumers, and infrastructure. But researchers say clean hydrogen may not be a quick fix in the shift away from fossil fuels. Our next guest says when it comes to climate change, a lot of it has to do with how you produce that hydrogen in the first place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of this clean hydrogen fuel? Have you seen a hydrogen-powered car? You have questions for our guest about how this works and the impact it has? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Robert Warren Howarth is a professor of ecology and environmental biology at Cornell University. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
We'll spend a lot of time, I think, on how we make the hydrogen, but I want to start with what we do with it once it's made. What are the uses for this hydrogen fuel in our energy economy?
Well, it's important to keep in mind that hydrogen historically has not been much of a fuel. We've used it for space rockets, but not much else. It's really an energy carrier. And of the hydrogen that's made today, it's overwhelmingly used to make synthetic nitrogen fertilizer and as a chemical feedstock, not really for energy. So the thought of using energy, hydrogen more broadly as an energy source is future looking. And we're looking for ways to store surplus renewable electricity, perhaps long distance truck and train transport, maybe long distance aviation, steel manufacturing, things of that sort. Those are what I'd consider the better uses. Hydrogen's also being promoted, I think, unfortunately, by some for use in, say, home heating. And I think that would be a very, very poor choice. So we can get into more details as to why as we go on, if you like.
Yeah, and well, with consumers, I think the thing they might hear about is this idea of a hydrogen fuel cell cars. This is not something I think we might see on the road on any given day. How close are we to having that be a reality?
Well, I'm a little skeptical of hydrogen cars being a big part of our future. I mean, the technology's there. We certainly can make hydrogen cars. Toyota has played around with that. They've made some, but they haven't really gone into commercial scale production. For the small passenger vehicle, you know, I think market forces have told us that we're moving to battery electric vehicles rather than hydrogen. They're more cost effective. They're more energetically effective as well. So I think, although there are some who still see a future for this hydrogen car, I think in transportation, where hydrogen comes into play is longer distances and bigger vehicles. So large semi-trailer trucks, perhaps hydrogen can compete against batteries. For passenger vehicles, I think that decision's already been made by the technologies and market forces over the last decade.
We're talking to Bob Howarth from Cornell University about hydrogen fuel, its future, its limitations, as states around the country, including Wisconsin, are angling for some federal money to get into the hydrogen business. You could join in with your questions, what you're seeing out there. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Bob, you've done some research into one of the means of making this, or of producing this hydrogen in a usable way, making it from natural gas. You're very concerned about the impact that has on climate change, not really a net gain, you write.
Yeah, no, I'm concerned, terribly concerned about it. Most all hydrogen now is actually made from natural gas. In the United States, 96% of the current hydrogen market's coming from natural gas. The industry, and that's been going on for a long time. The technology for that was invented 120 years ago. So this is not new technology. And it actually hasn't changed much over the last 80 to 90 years. The natural gas industry, though, has just in the last few years come up with this idea that they call blue hydrogen, which is making hydrogen from natural gas, only capturing carbon dioxide from the process and sequestering that. And they started marketing this idea as either clean hydrogen or as zero emissions or low emissions hydrogen. And that's just plain wrong. Mark Jacobson, a very talented engineer at Stanford, and I published a paper a little over a year ago, August of 2021, where we looked at the true greenhouse gas footprint of this idea of blue hydrogen. And again, that's the hydrogen from natural gas with carbon capture. And what we showed was that it actually has a larger greenhouse gas consequence than if one were simply to burn the natural gas. And there are two reasons for that. One is that not all of the carbon dioxide is effectively captured at all, and it actually takes a lot of energy to capture that carbon dioxide. So you're using more fuel, and there's some more emissions with that. And the other is that natural gas is composed mostly of methane. It is that methane and natural gas that's the chemical feedstock for making hydrogen, but they also burn natural gas to provide the heat and energy to make this. And some unburned methane inevitably escapes to the atmosphere when you develop and use natural gas in any form. And hydrogen is an incredibly potent greenhouse gas. So what we demonstrated is that those methane emissions, together with the incomplete carbon dioxide capture, make this a very, very poor choice for fuel.
I believe as Governor Evers and his colleagues in other states, their goal here with this regional hydrogen hub would be to make the hydrogen, produce the hydrogen, or I guess extract the hydrogen in a different way from water. H2O, those two H's are hydrogen. What do those methods look like for extracting the hydrogen?
Yeah, no, that is the other way to go. It's what we call electrolysis. So you're breaking down the H2 and the O in H2O into hydrogen and oxygen gas, just putting electricity into it. That technology is also quite old. It's been around since the 1890s or so. To date, it is not a dominant market force for hydrogen simply because it's been expensive relative to making natural gas-based hydrogen in the past. But as we move into a future where renewable electricity is increasingly our source of electricity, it makes sense, to use hydrogen as a storage compound for times when the we're providing surplus solar electricity or solar wind electricity in particular. And as the price of renewable electricity is coming down, this price of that hydrogen, we call that green hydrogen, is also coming down. And the equipment which does the electrolysis, the electrolyzers, are becoming more efficient and far more cost effective as well. So I think that's the future that I hope hydrogen will be. There is a competition, and quite frankly, oil and gas industry would love to confuse that with what they're marketing from their natural gas hydrogen, and they call both of those clean, and one is clean. The electrolysis from renewable electricity, the green hydrogen, is truly clean. The other is very, very dirty.
And I guess another key is that availability of renewable energy at a scale. Because I guess if I'm using electricity, I could use electricity from a coal-powered power plant to do the electrolysis and separate out that hydrogen. That clearly, I'm guessing, is not going to be a net gain when it comes to climate emissions.
No, that's not such a good idea either, right? So, no. Quite frankly, often we are better off just using electricity directly as an energy source as opposed to putting it through hydrogen at all. So I think hydrogen definitely has a role in our decarbonized energy future, but it's not, I think it's a relatively limited role. And again, long distance transportation, perhaps manufacturing of steel, and as a storage product for surplus renewable electricity. But if we can use the electricity directly instead, it's often more efficient to do so and more cost effective.
Right. Let's talk about that situation now. We've got a great sunny day or a great windy day. The respective generators are producing more electricity than we need right now. You were suggesting that is a role where carbon might be able to absorb some of that extra energy. And then what? Is that hydrogen sitting there as a battery for off-peak times, or are we transporting it to use for other uses?
Well, you could do either, but it makes sense to, rather than just dissipating that surplus electricity. And there are parts, say, of the United States currently where surplus wind energy can't get to market because we don't have adequate cable connections. Using that to produce hydrogen and then either feeding it back into the grid or perhaps for some other use. But I think often feeding it back into the grid would be the preferred use. And we can do that through fuel cells as well, which is a fairly high efficiency technology, unpolluting. So I think that might be the best future for us to be thinking about.
So I can use hydrogen. This hydrogen fuel cell as a big battery instead of, I guess, a big, lithium battery or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. And those two technologies are in competition, right? They both can store electricity, and they have pluses and minuses both. The lithium batteries are expensive, for instance, and we have to deal with the lithium issues. There are other ways to store surplus electricity, compressed air, liquefied air, which you then feed back through turbines. So I'm not 100% sure that hydrogen is going to be the dominant force for this battery, if you will, in the future, but it may well be, and it's certainly one that we should be exploring and developing and making as efficient as possible as part of the energy future.
We're talking to Robert Warren Howarth, professor of ecology and environmental biology at Cornell University, with us today to talk about the use of hydrogen in our energy system. Wisconsin joining a partnership with three other states looking for federal money to develop a regional hydrogen hub. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Well, as I was researching this, I was impressed with how little I knew about hydrogen. Are you in the same boat as me? Do you have a question about how this works, what we do with it, how we make it? Join in at 800-642-1234. And do you think hydrogen should be a priority of, say, federal funding, state research, corporate research? Or are there other alternative energy solutions you'd like to see on the front burner? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about hydrogen and its potential uses as part of a clean energy future. Robert Warren Howarth from Cornell University stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the use of hydrogen in energy technology? Are you hopeful for it? Skeptical about it? Do you have questions about it? Join in at 800-642-1234. where do you want to see things like federal and state money go when it comes to funding for research on alternative energy sources? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Bob, as you mentioned earlier, one use that's been floated for this hydrogen is home heating. You mentioned briefly earlier you're skeptical about that as a good use. Why is that?
I'm beyond skeptical. I think it's a terrible use for several reasons. One, the natural gas industry has started marketing this idea quite heavily that they will blend hydrogen into our traditional natural gas delivery systems and allow people to use it for home heating. And the fact is that you actually have to put a lot of hydrogen into the pipeline in order to have any significant reduction in the greenhouse gas emissions from burning the ultimate fuel, even if the hydrogen itself is truly green and clean up front. And that's partly because it's just a lower energy density fuel. As you use it, you need to increase the pressurization in the pipelines, and that makes the pipelines leakier. They emit more methane, which is already a big problem. It makes them more dangerous. Hydrogen also makes the pipelines more brittle, which increases the chances of a catastrophic event, an explosion. And so the California Air Resources Board, for instance, has recently ruled that we should not let industry put more than 5% hydrogen into a natural gas pipeline system. And they're hoping that with further research that that might go up to 20%. You know, those blendings of 5 to 20% are just meaningless in terms of truly decarbonizing the heating system. So it's just not effective. But beyond that, you know, let's say that we're making our hydrogen from renewable electricity, as I argue that we should. If you start with a unit of renewable electricity and you convert it into hydrogen, there's some inefficiency there. If you then transport the hydrogen to a home through a pipeline, there are inefficiencies there. You burn it in a traditional home furnace, even with high efficiencies, and there are inefficiencies there. So overall, you're getting about 45% of that original electric energy is showing up as heat energy in your home. If you instead take that renewable electricity and put it through the wires to your home and use a high efficiency heat pump, you can actually get four and a half, five times more heat energy out than you're putting into electricity. So what that means is that for the same amount of renewable electricity, we get 10 times, eight times more heat energy in our home if we're using a high-efficiency electric heat pump as opposed to going through this hydrogen thing. So together with all those problems, it's just I don't really know anyone who's a serious engineer or scientist working on hydrogen who thinks it's a good idea. I think it's just playing a marketing scheme for the natural gas industry.
Yeah, can you talk about the infrastructure or lack of same for transporting hydrogen if we're going to do something other than what you said, use it as that sort of on-site electrical storage device for excess renewable energy production?
Right. Well, hydrogen is transported some in pipelines now, but there's special pipelines that are made for hydrogen as opposed for natural gas. It has to be using a quality of steel that's much more resistant to corrosion. It's much more expensive. Stainless steel, high-quality stainless steel, essentially. It's difficult and expensive to transport it. And I would note that, you know, hydrogen is the absolute smallest molecule in the entire universe, smallest molecule on Earth. And that means that it's very, very difficult to contain. It's very leaky. If you remember back, NASA's been having problems trying to get some of their spacecraft going over the last month or so with fuel leaks. Those fuel leaks are hydrogen leaks. And, you know, here you have some of the best engineers in the world. They're struggling to contain the hydrogen. It is very, very slippery, leaky stuff. So it's not that we can't handle it, we can't use it, but it's expensive and technologically challenging. And I think the less transporting we do of it, the better, both in terms of safety and cost effectiveness.
Talking to Bob Howarth from Cornell University, looking at the opportunities and the limitations of hydrogen in our energy system as Wisconsin seeks and other states seek to get federal money to develop hydrogen, produce it, and use it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. John joins us now in Rhinelander. John, hi.
Hi there. I wanted to ask about the comparative cost to consumers of different storage. Now, I know batteries are coming down towards $25 a kilowatt hour as far as the storage to buy it. I don't know how much hydrogen would cost to consumers. You know, how much would that add to the bill, your power bill or your bill for charging your car? And how much would hydrogen add to it? And in these other mechanical means of storage, whatever, you know, I got a feeling probably batteries are going to beat everybody out, you know.
John, thanks for the call. Do batteries have a leg up on hydrogen and other electricity storage options, Bob?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, John. It's hard to give a definitive answer. I mean, the whole storage technology is changing so rapidly and improving so rapidly. So, you know, batteries are far more effective and cheaper now than they were 5 to 10 years ago. Lithium batteries have come a long way. There are other battery technologies that are coming along, which are, I'm told I'm not a battery expert, but I have expert friends who tell me that they're likely to be far less expensive yet and perhaps more effective. So, you know, batteries are going to get better and better and cheaper and cheaper. Hydrogen remains pretty expensive, but the process for making it is coming down, partly as the renewable electricity costs come down, but also as those electrolyzers come down. And some of the other technologies are perhaps cost competitive as well. I mentioned compressed air, and there are people experimenting with large storage of surplus electricity from compressed air and letting it back out. I think we're going to see dramatic changes in all of these technologies over the coming decade, and I think we should keep an open mind, probably invest in research heavily in all of them, but keep an open mind as to where the real winners are going to be for that.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Bob, this the Infrastructure Act put money in different kinds of renewable energy resource. What's your read on the priority of hydrogen? Do you think it's getting the appropriate amount of money here, given that there are other options on the table?
I think there's too much emphasis on hydrogen, quite frankly, in the funding. And some of that is earmarked, if you will, towards hydrogen that's made from natural gas. I don't think that's ideal. I mean, overall, I'm a big supporter of the IRA. It's world-changing legislation. There's an awful lot of good stuff in there, but there's a lot of stuff that I personally would have liked to have seen not be put in there. And the subsidies for carbon capture and storage and tying that to making hydrogen from natural gas, I just think is it's going to be a waste of money. I don't think those technologies are going to pan out. If for no other reason, I mean, I'm concerned about the greenhouse gas consequences of making hydrogen that way. I think it's going to be technologically really challenging to do it well enough. The green hydrogen from renewable electricity and electrolysis of water clearly went out there. But I think that's going to be true even economically. I mean, at the moment that green hydrogen is somewhat more expensive than hydrogen from natural gas, but natural gas prices are high. They're going to stay high. They're probably going to creep up over time over the next decade. And the green hydrogen prices are coming down. So the economic analyses I've seen say that certainly within the decade, green hydrogen will be more economical than any hydrogen made from fossil fuel. So, you know, why are we wasting time trying to keep the fossil fuel component of that going? I think that's a mistake in what otherwise is a really, really important bill.
In just our last half minute, if you could take that money that went where you didn't want it, where would you put it in alternative energy right now?
I think making a big push for heat pumps, getting fossil fuels out of our homes and putting in heat pumps there, maybe community-based ground source heat pumps would be a great way to go. And really pushing ahead with these energy storage technologies, electric storage, but also thermal storage. You know, we know how to build wind turbines. We know solar. We are going to need some electrical storage. The research is going on, but that should be a very high priority.
Bob, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That's Robert Warren Howarth, professor of ecology and environmental biology at Cornell. He was with us today to talk about hydrogen as a possible source of clean fuel after Governor Evers launched a joint effort with three other states trying to win funding for hydrogen projects here in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Colorado legalized marijuana 10 years ago. Find out what's happened since then and lessons learned for other states. And you can join the conversation with your thoughts and questions as always. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8. That's here on the Ideas Network. We have a winner in the highly anticipated Fat Bear Week competition at Katmai National Park in Alaska. The winner is the bear known as 747, who also won in 2020. In the contest, members of the public voted in a bracket competition to reward the bears who did the best job fattening up on salmon over the season. The competition website says 747 is, quote, a skilled and efficient angler who's often found fishing in the jacuzzi or near the far pool of Brooks Falls. The jacuzzi is the nickname for the little whirlpool area by the falls. Regular listeners know I've been a fan of these brown bears at Katmai for a couple years now. I follow them on the live Brooks Falls webcams. I've shared those with friends and coworkers and with you. In the past, it seems like it's more under the radar, but this year I'm seeing a lot of media outlets cover Fat Bear Week. Am I saying I put those bears on the map? No, of course not. They earned their fame all on their own. Congratulations to 747 for the big win. This is Central Time.